the Off the Ball Podcast Network.
Paddy Power, as much a part of Irish football as hoofing it up to Johnny Walters.
We'll get to Pat Nevin in just one second, but I'm just seeing Dan McDonald, some breaking news on Couser here, tweeting that Gary Owens is the new interim CEO of the FAI, previously interim CEO with Down Syndrome Ireland and Athletics Ireland. I don't have a huge amount of other information about him, but the FAI needed an interim CEO, certainly. So Gary Owens is the name they have gone for.
Yeah, well, not to sort of, well, that's what we do. I did have a story last week that an interim CEO was coming, but I'm surprised by the sort of swiftness of this announcement. But although Paul Cook has been acting as executive lead there, the information I had last week was that sort of new independent directors, people who come in, felt that they needed sort of another. Someone who's working full-time day-to-day as a CEO-type figure in the building on an interim basis, because it's going to be a while before they can appoint a full-time one. And there's a lot going on there. And while a lot of people are placing stock on the independent directors, they're not actually full-time employees of the association. They have day jobs. Mm. So there's a lot to consider where the game is going. Business plans, refinancing plans, etc. And there was a feeling that they needed extra bodies there, and well, that's what they've done. They brought somebody. I don't know a huge amount about him. The name was mentioned in dispatches at one point, but not someone I have to admit now. I googled him and that was about as far as it went.
Well, I'm seeing he went in as an interim CEO with Athletics Ireland about 10 years ago, and he's been previously interim CEO with Down Syndrome Ireland, so clearly he's someone who can go in and do a job on an interim basis and has in the past, and he's starting with immediate effect, we hear as well. So they needed a name, they needed someone in there, someone with credibility who can effectively organise the bailout or the guarantee.
That's I'm not sure if they're going to be doing that. So what I heard last week, I think that ultimately Roy Barrett who's the chairman. I mean, I think in terms of he's drawing up the plans or drawing up a proposal to go to, you know, to UEFA, to government, and more pertinently the banks, to see can they work out a plan. I don't think the interim CEO will be doing anything in that plan. I think they're more going to be activating the plan, i.e. like if there's decisions to be made about jobs or where cuts are made or how we do it, they need someone on hand to sort of execute that. So I think that may be the task at hand for the CEO might be more managing, almost working in parallel with this process. It's almost as though I don't think you would bring in an interim CEO if you didn't think that maybe you were going to escape this doomsday scenario, and that actually the interim CEO might have to more so manage whatever cutbacks or whatever stuff needs to be done. I think that's possibly where this person might come in.
Okay, Dan McDonald, the Irish Independent, thank you. Let's get to Pat Nevin, who's been waiting very patiently. Hello, come on in. How you doing?
I'm very well, very well. That's definitely a good reason to jump over and get some breaking news there. Very important breaking news as well.
We have breaking news surrounding the FAI on an almost hourly basis. Someone's either been fired or appointed or resigned, or some doomsday scenario that we hadn't even contemplated has cropped up. That's generally how it's been going for about a year.
Excellent, excellent. interim, so it won't be that lasting that long. No. Steady the ship, that's the old idea. Never works.
Well, we're hoping. So it was very striking yesterday at Anfield that Liverpool fans, for the first time really, sang out with "We're going to win the league." Even, you know, they, after 30 years, have been very slow, even in the context of a mammoth lead, to throw that one out, and maybe understandably so. But it was kind of striking as well, because Liverpool probably won't get the euphoric, dramatic Aguero moment that will seal a league win. In some respects, Salah's goal yesterday might be as close to that kind of a moment as they get, the celebratory relief, we've done it, we're home kind of a moment for them.
I think particularly the Salah goal, you know, the way the goal was actually scored as well, breaking from such depth, you know, still a little bit of pressure on them with 1-0 up, but not really that much, to be honest. And then suddenly, you know, you break away like that, and it felt like a release. And you're absolutely right. I thought it was very noticeable. You know, when you seen that moment there, when you saw, you know, him going there, celebrating the way he did, and then the fans singing the way they sang. Yeah, it did feel like the moment where they can kind of relax now. And I think they're right to do so. Also, there's another little thing I think it's kind of important. the Liverpool fans are quite aware. There's been quite a lot in the newspapers over here. They're doing stories on why we hate the idea of Liverpool winning the league. And it's fans of every other club saying that. And it's kind of an odd thing, isn't it? You don't really hear that so much with Man United or anyone else that much. But you've got a lot of that just now going on. People saying, well, we don't want them, anyone else but them. So they don't want to be too smug about it. It's beyond smug now. It's just, this is going to happen.
Now the smugness will kick in. I don't know. I mean, ABU was a massive thing in the 90s, and even ABU chants were sung at England games.
Yeah, it can happen, you know, absolutely, it can happen. You don't know, honestly always know why it comes up. I've asked lots of my friends and acquaintances, and if they're Chelsea fans or Everton fans, I get it, why they might not want Liverpool to win anything, or might not like them. There's history there. So Man United, Everton, Chelsea, they'll have it. But it's other fans as well. It's something else cultural that's kind of gone on. Kind of hard to put your finger on it. Maybe they've just enjoyed sort of smiling a wee bit as the expectations grow. But I do think the more often I hear it, the most often answer I hear when I ask why don't you want Liverpool to win it is because they all say it's because the media are on their side. Absolutely on their side. One, they may win it more than anyone else. And for a long, long time, particularly over in the UK, there was a lot of Liverpool and ex-Liverpool players who were on the media, and there's still quite a lot there, but who were right in your face all the time. And that used to miff quite a lot of people, and they felt, rightly or wrongly, that they were getting a sort of better shake at it.
Mm. Yeah, it's interesting. I haven't noticed it in any great way over here. Maybe it's not as visceral a thing when you're not coming across Liverpool fans from the city or as exposed to the media over there. I mean, certainly some of the marketing around Liverpool, but even as I'm saying this is true of most clubs, but it can rankle a little bit, like the whole this it means more thing, you know, Liverpool means more, Liverpool's almost a purer version of football and a football club. I can see how that gets on people's wick.
Well, the bit that got me, the one I thought I can't argue against this, was when Liverpool, the last time the expectation was that we're going to win the league, and it was at the time the Stevie G slip and all that sort of stuff. Yeah. There was helicopters following the team bus to the game. I think that doesn't happen with anyone else. And everyone else out with whoever sent that helicopter up was going, what are you doing? It's just a league game.
Yeah.
Don't turn up as if it's a cup final at the game, at a league game at home. Just don't do that. You know, it's a league game. It doesn't happen with anyone else. But it was like a procession and that. It jumped out to me that one. I thought, well, that's just weird because I've never seen that happen with anyone else. So, and that was just the absolute sort of crossing the T and dotting the I for a lot of people who thought that was certainly a media problem. And not just like, I'm not talking personnel, I'm not talking in the olden days, Hansen and people like that. I'm not talking that group. I'm talking about people who run television stations and run the sports departments. Okay. You know, it felt there was a big Liverpool bias there.
Right, okay. I'd always been under the impression that there were a disproportionate number of Spurs fans amongst the football journalists. So, I mean, maybe it's funny. Our commentators on Off the Ball Sunday games get abused for impartiality, and it's staggering the amount of times that people get it wrong who they actually support. You know, we know here, and people hear what they want to hear, so there's that going on. The thing with Liverpool is the whole it means more thing and this sense of, well, we're a special club, special fans. Like there is a basis for it as well. Like when you watch European nights there, when you watch what the city has been through, when you watch how the fans really took the Hillsborough fight to the Tories and to all levels of government, there is something a bit special about them as well. So I can see how it peeves people, but then equally there is a grain of truth in it, maybe more than a grain of truth of it, to be fair.
There's the other side to it as well. Remember, it's a provincial city. Mm. It's a small city in comparison to even Manchester, certainly London. And you've got a smallish city up there. And I'd say that with all respect of Dublin and Glasgow and, you know, Liverpool. You know, they're good cities, they're proud cities, but in size-wise, they don't compete with your Madrids and your Parises and your Londons, right? But this is a team that's won incredible amounts of things from a city that's seen from a slightly more provincial sort of city. So there is that. There's also that other little thing, having spent time 5 years sort of playing up there, you understand something else about it. It's quite an introverted city. You know, it doesn't look out as much as, see, Manchester is much more of a city that kind of looks out towards the world, etc. But Liverpool's a bit more inside itself. Now, that's not an abusive term to say that. They just kind of love their own culture, and there's a hell of a lot of good culture there. You know, the way back to the Beatles, etc. So there is that kind of, you know, that thing where they are looking that way, and they scrutinise themselves positively and negatively more than maybe a lot of other cities do. So they say it's special because it's them. It's them against the world. I would often explain to people, look, when I was playing there, if you walked down the street and I walked down the street with Tom Cruise, people would talk to me first. It's because, you know, stars, and football was everything. It was number one. Then music, then the rest of the world will have a look at them. Mm. And that's just the way the city is. It's really quiet and, you know, look, introspective.
Well, regardless of how everybody feels about it, they are going to win the league, that much is sure. As for the game itself, we've had various interpretations of this. And I think maybe it depends on just how lowly you're pitching Manchester United just now. How did you see the game? Was this a display of a massive gulf in class, or were United far better than maybe some have been giving them credit for?
Well, I've seen them up and down recently. United, we've seen them stink the place out at Arsenal a few weeks ago. And then they were okay against Norwich last. But then you come up against a good team. I have to say, at no point did I think that Manchester United were going to get much out of that game. Then you take Rashford out of the team and you think, well, that's a long, long, long shot. There was a couple of good moments. Good moment from Martial, nearly got shot on target. There was a through ball that James should have played had he played it through. And it was just moments like that. Mm. The point is, it was just moments like that. The control of most of the game that Liverpool had, and the fact that you kind of thought there was maybe a gear or two to go to as well. And I think that's maybe the thing, that when you're watching it, yeah, there might be moments from United, and not just United, but other teams as well. And then you look at Liverpool and think, yep, they can do it when they want to. They can turn it on when they want to. And there were just some great displays again. And once again, Van Dijk, some of his passing was ridiculous, absolutely off the scale. And just look around, and one or two turn up to put on, you know, 9 out of 10 performances when they need to. So was it a golfing class between Liverpool and Man United? Yeah, absolutely. Is it a golfing class between them and everyone else? Yeah, generally, absolutely. That's the case. They have been amazing. And the run of games now is just... I just never thought that I'd see a team do this in the modern era. But they're doing it and kind of with ease most of the time.
So even, say, in the close... Well, after the second half, we got a glimpse of Liverpool upping the gears and in the mood, and things could have happened very badly for Manchester United there. There could have been 2-3 goals very, very easily. But in that closing 15 minutes, when United were not just trying to sucker punch Liverpool, but actually in Liverpool's half and dominating, again, might be a strong word, but on the ball and creating chances, or creating a certain kind of nerviness in Liverpool, and Klopp switched formation as well. How do you explain that? Was that good United play, or is that Liverpool saying, we've had our moment, let's just see this out now?
It's a bit of both, but okay. I think it's more to do with Liverpool's management of the game. So right. Just, I've been to see them too often. And it's when you sit in amongst the Liverpool fans now, right, and when you're doing the media, you're in that massive big news stand and you're surrounded by them. There's just no panic. There's no worry. There's no fear, really. You're the kind of, they've got the feeling, knowledgeable fan base, sitting going, yeah, we know it's coming. It's okay. It's fine. You've got this one. And it's even when you're under a little bit of pressure, you'd say, yeah, we've got it. It's okay. And they've also got that added thing is, yeah, we've got it. And if we haven't got it, then so what? We've still got loads of points ahead. Mm. It's a real comfort and a real confidence about the place. And that's the way I kind of describe it. It's really quite comfortable. And asking Liverpool to play 100 miles an hour for 90 minutes for every single game when they're this far ahead, when they can be comfortable and save their energies for when they're really needed, I just think it's brilliant game management that they've got. And it's not just Klopp, it's kind of the group of players. They've all got it.
It's incredibly striking at the moment, the disparity in views on Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. And we're at a point now where people are trying to figure out if United are justified and doing the right thing in showing real faith in Solskjaer. And the problem, you watch Keenan Carragher yesterday, for instance, the problem is he doesn't have much of a CV to analyse. So we're almost picking out smaller things to see, well, where is he now and where is he now? And there's very different views on that. If you look at what he did yesterday, so Bissaka and Williams in particular, that, you know, pushing up on Trent Alexander-Arnold and Robertson and the three centre backs, did that signal to you a certain sophistication, creativity, a tactical nous? Did you look at that and think, well, that's a really good plan? There's a bit of promise there in a manager who can dream that up. That was good.
It wasn't massively complicated, but it should. I like the bravery of it, the fact that you're willing to, you know, have a go, adapt it, change it when in those situations. I mean, most of the teams that go to Liverpool, most of the teams that play against Manchester City, they play in a certain way, you know, and they just get a bit mind the ball, play in the break, etc. So, and it, from I think Man United would probably have done that is a little bit more and kind of sat and then tried to do that. Had they had Rashford as well up there, it's a more sensible game to do that. But without him, you can't do it. So you have to rethink it. I thought it was quite intelligent, if it was okay. Mm. It was nothing spectacularly out of the ordinary. And remember, the problems that were caused when Wan-Bissaka did go forward and then forgot to go back and Robertson got behind him time again. That's kind of works against him. It's one of those ones, it's the easiest thing in the world after games when you're looking at players and you go, you got that wrong because A, B and C went wrong. And you're thinking, well, C, D, and E and F would have gone wrong had you not done that. It is one of those ones where I'm not sure there was an obvious way with the group of players that he had available to him that he could have really laid that much of a glove on that Liverpool team. Remember, he's not got McTominay, he's not got Pogba, he's not got Rashford. It's kind of the spine of a team, really. And if you're going to try and play against Liverpool, you know, particularly at Anfield, you need everything. You need everybody and you need them all up for it and you need them all on form. It was a long way back. And to be honest, if I had it finished 1-0 like it could have done, you'd probably have shrugged those shoulders and said, well, there's no great embarrassment there. The 2-0 just kind of hurt a wee bit for them. I just felt a wee bit sad. There was a moment that happened near the end of the game because I've got a theory about one of the United players and an odd one, Wan-Bissaka. Just watch him. See me watch him. Just watch him try and cross a football. He can't do it, right? It's the funniest thing. Yeah. He can do everything else. He's a good player. But I've mentioned this to quite a few people. He doesn't actually strike a ball very good. Did you see him try to shoot a ball the last minute there against... and then they break away and, you know, the goalkeeper gets it, throws it up, Salah scores. But it happened quite a lot. And I feel quite sorry for him because see when you look at all the other right-backs just now, they're all absolutely brilliant. All these English ones come through. Reece James is hammering these Beckham-like crosses, and you know, you get Alexander Arnold, you get amazing delivery. And the thing is, poor Wan-Bissaka, he's got lots to go for him, but he's not got that, and that's what's going to hold him back for being a top player at right back for England, particularly.
Yeah, well, actually, that brings us on to the more general point I wanted to ask you about. It kind of came up in the Carragher-Keane discussion, where Carragher was making the point that Klopp has improves players. You know, players sign for Liverpool and they improve, and that doesn't happen enough in the game. So the first general point, I'm going to come back to Liverpool and United, but did you improve across your career, or did you just get to a certain point at 24 where you thought, well, that's my lot now? Because I suspect a lot of professional footballers, even though they're training every day, when they get to 24, 25, they kind of think, well, that's just what I am.
I think it is quite common that, you know, because you've learned, it's taken many, many years to learn what you're good at. So what you do is refine what you're good at and get very, very good at that. Of course, that's unbelievably dangerous because people realise what you're good at. I spent my entire time every year to try to completely reinvent, you know, totally different way of looking at it. Hopefully playing in different positions throughout my career as well, which helps a little bit. But I mean, I can remember when I started, I would be taking around four or five players going in big, mazy dribbles all the time. And you got known for that. And it kind of sticks with you. But in actual fact, 3 or 4 years down the line, what you're doing is you're tracking it and dragging it and pulling four or five players towards you so that somebody else can run into space and you can flick them through. You've adapted that little thing. Mm. You've made sure that you work and you adapt it. And that's learning. I don't know if you're a better player, but you're an adapted player. There's not that many. I would say centre halves are excluded from this discussion because they just keep on usually getting better because they've got a lot to learn. But the other positions, yeah, generally if you're a good player, they kind of come static. But every now and again, one or two of them comes through. And I think they jump out at you. You know, Raheem Sterling being my favourite example at the moment of a player that, you know, he was a good player. And he's unbelievable. You think, where the hell did that come from? But there's others. And hands up, hold my hand up now, one that I did not see coming, Adama Traore. I just thought he couldn't play. I just thought he was hopeless. But in actual fact, I just thought he was dead quick and could kick a ball quite hard. Mm. But in actual fact, he's actually shown a bit more of that just now since he's gone to Wolves. So you can improve. You need good coaching and you need a willingness from the player as well. It's amazing how irregularly that happens. And by the way, while you mentioned Klopp improving players, let's be fair. You know, I think Pep improves players at least as much and probably more. over the years since Klopp has done.
Yeah, Sterling maybe is the most extreme example, isn't it? It's extraordinary what he did with him. So Carragher made the point, well, managers aren't doing that anymore. He said Solskjaer is not really doing it. And I thought maybe that was a touch harsh because Fred looks to be improving. Yeah. McTominay looks to be improving. Rashford, away from the tyranny of Mourinho, is scoring more goals. Scored more goals than anybody at Liverpool this year. Martial, even though there might be more in him, you feel he's improving. So the question on Bissaka, surely it is within a coach's power to turn Bissaka into a good crosser in the next 6 months.
I don't think so. I'm not sure. I think he's got an unusual running style, and I think there might be a body shape problem there. So I'm not sure you can ever make a great crosser. I think you can make him adequate and be the first man and things like that. But there's other areas you can work on. It's okay if you know a guy's got, somebody's not very good at one certain thing.
Yeah.
Well, you manipulate it so that you drag in other people in places, you lay it back, then they swing it in. There's ways around it. There's always ways around it. But I think it's harsh on Solskjaer to say that. It's easy to look for simple answers like that. Hmm. I think there's a limitation in the squad. If you look at them player for player and compare what Manchester United and what Ole has got as a team player for player, with the teams above them, they're not as good. You know, particularly, obviously, City and Liverpool. Who has he brought in? Well, Maguire, he's done all right. He's done the job. He's come in to do a job, and he's generally done it pretty well. I don't think there's been that many complaints about him. Wan-Bissaka's done okay. You know, he's just done okay. Mm. The young lads that he's brought through, they've actually done really quite well. So I think it's a wee bit harsh on him. The expectations just higher at Manchester United. And if you've got that level of expectations, but with not the players to deliver it, then you're struggling. And especially with the injuries that you mentioned before as well.
Yeah. The extraordinary thing is we're talking about a club with the second highest wage bill in world football, and they've spent £1 billion since Alex Ferguson left. And this is where they are. That is the mad thing. Time is coming again.
No joined up thinking, that's the problem. Oh, you need to joined up thinking, that's the problem.
To say the least. Anything else from the weekend that caught your interest or you want to mention before we go?
Well, as usual, I was following. I've got a game tomorrow and Chelsea-Arsenal tomorrow. Then the next day I'm going to Leicester and they're playing against West Ham. But a game against, I was at the weekend, there was Chelsea up in Newcastle. I live quite near to Newcastle, so easy nap down. And honestly, I've never seen such a groundhog day of football in my life. It was total groundhog day. You're watching and thinking, yeah, Chelsea are going to get all the ball. They ain't going to score. They keep on doing exactly the same thing. They keep on passing it. Really, 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 really nice. Somebody's going to hang it across and they're going to lose a goal. And it's happening all the time with them. And for Chelsea, you look at how close they are, how well they are doing in the league so far, and considering the games that they have lost to Bournemouth, Southampton, West Ham, now Newcastle, teams that they were battering for the whole game in terms of possession, but still lose those points, they actually could quite easily have been right on the tails of Manchester City just now, albeit for that one problem. That's why I'm giving it 10 days now, and I really hope they buy Zaha, because that's the only thing that's going to answer that question.
Okay. Brilliant stuff. We'll talk to you next week.
Look forward to it. See ya.
See ya. Pat Nevin with us every Monday. Back in a sec.
The Football Show on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power, the greatest football partnership since Shearer and Owen.
I'm prepared to anything I can.
Well, do it then.
Come see again.
Do it then. What about your start to the game?
It wasn't bad, was it?
Why should an honest answer be a mistake?
How can a modern day manager not have a mobile phone?
Why should he?
Well, here we go. Busy football show. Dan McDonald in the house of the Irish Independent, of course. Hello, Dan.
Joe, I'm good. How are you?
Very well. You enjoyed the Premier League football over the weekend?
I sort of watched Liverpool Man United game yesterday. The weekend in general, yeah, I suppose. Yeah, Man City, obviously a bit of drama on Saturday and I was going to say losing. Didn't actually lose, but it sort of felt like they did lose. And it was an okay weekend, I guess.
On Pep Guardiola's birthday as well, Dan. The ignominy.
Add to it.
Let me refresh your memory. So Watford, with a little sprinkle of Nigel Pearson magic these days, drew nil all at home to Spurs. Harry Kane-less Spurs, they're not going so well.
I actually watched QPR Leeds at that time instead because Conor Masterman was playing, but it didn't really grab me. Mourinho Spurs already, I can just happily not watch them. You know what I mean? Given the choice, I went for option B.
Man City 2, Crystal Palace 2, Fernandinho own goal. We had Arsenal really, I think, bedding in nicely with Arteta's mid-table plan in a 1-1 draw at home to Sheffield United. Southampton 2, Wolves 3. Can we mention Shane Long briefly?
It looked great for Southampton at half-time, because I was in here on Saturday and it's like, geez, Ralph Hasenhüttl, and didn't really get into it, but when you consider, you know, after the 9-0, he could easily have got the bullet, and like, you know, it's a testament to just not having a knee-jerk response. And to be fair, they've done well. They've got a great result at Chelsea. They've steadied the ship, but just a bit disappointed on Saturday. They were 2-0 and lost 3-2. But Shane Long, definitely his own revival, and you know, that of James McCarthy as well, who played for Crystal Palace. You know, you're talking about in a year we're talking about the kids and the Irish kids and all of that being a very positive story. Yeah, a bit of a revival for those lads. I mean, Shane Long's in the last year of a good contract there at Southampton, so he needed to do something this year, and he is doing it. And I think if the squad was being picked for Slovakia tomorrow, I think he'd definitely be in it. He'd have to be, really.
James McCarthy on corners for Crystal Palace. I don't remember him taking corners.
No, and there was actually a game recently he towards the end of it was on corners and they weren't very good. I didn't see too many of them on Saturday. What they did score a goal from a corner was that one he sort of floated it in.
Yes.
Wasn't exactly the most. It wasn't a David Beckham style delivery, but it was functional and effective.
It's from the outswinger side, but he doesn't really outswing it. He more just pings it straight with the laces, floats one in. That's his speciality.
Still, you know, he's showing something in training to be given that responsibility.
Well, it's more of a stick it, float it to the back post and let them head it back across type.
Whatever you do, just beat the front man, beat the first man.
It's not really a Van Dijk, I want to attack this ball, I can use the pace on the ball type.
No, that's a fair point. Yeah. Although it's like a couple of Liverpool corners yesterday actually weren't that good. Just so happened that they did score from a pretty good one, but some of their later deliveries weren't as hot.
No, one went right over the back. Shane Long, Ralph Hasenhüttl, excuse me, Dan, has been praising Shane Long both pre-game and then post-game. He seems to be a genuine fan of Long. Mm. And then after the game, he said, he's not, Dan, a typical Wall player. What does that mean to you?
A Wall player?
Yeah.
I'm actually not sure. I mean, I could bluff it and just pretend.
I think what it means is Long is not the type of player with an immaculate touch where if you play a 1-2 with Long.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Like a Wall. He'll give you the ball back.
Good line,
actually. He'll put you through. And he's not that type of player.
He's never been that type of player.
Who's a good Wall player that we have? McGoldrick,
yeah.
He is a good Wall player.
He can function as a Wall.
Yes. Whereas he says, Long, more of a guy who can run a lot, but he's still strong, really good in aerial duels. He wins the ball, and that is the reason why he's playing, even if he's not scoring all the time. That was before he scored.
Yeah.
So I think Hasenhüttl respects what Long, when he's got a bit of confidence, can bring. He can be a real menace.
No, like there's no doubt when he's confident. He is, I think he's always been a confidence player, Shane Long, though, as well. I think his good patches have come in streaks, you know, and he's had a great spell at Southampton under Koeman. Then it's sort of, you know, he's had wilderness year, you know, here and there, and that mad stat where I think he'd scored only one goal for a number of successive managers. So the consistency has been the problem as much as anything. On a given day, he can be very good, but just hasn't been able to necessarily string those displays together. But it's a welcome revival. And you know, David McGoldrick is Ireland's number one striker. I think he will play if he's fit. But still, he hasn't been scoring a huge amount. And we do know Shane Long can come off the bench and impact games. So that may well be his role in March.
Do we now have too many strikers playing in the Premier League?
We need to get to the point where we need less. We need fewer options. Like, this is totally getting carried away with ourselves here. But maybe if we just go through the weekend and get back to it, we just had four or five players involved in the Premier League weekend. This whole like nine starters on Saturday afternoon is... It's not on.
It's overwhelming.
Just too many to keep up with.
And Norwich 1, Bournemouth 0. Funny, of all the results across the weekend, bar the United-Liverpool game, that was the one I was looking out for, because I like Eddie Howe, I like Bournemouth, and I would like to see them stay up. And against bottom of the table Norwich, you felt that needed to happen. Howe's been saying, you know, for me, there's only one way to react, by fighting back, keep going, trying to prove people wrong. It doesn't make me question my role at the club at all. It makes me focused on my role to win matches. They're in trouble. They need to get loan players in or signings in, because injuries have decimated any attacking threat they had. You would presume the club, even if they're facing relegation, will look at Eddie Howe and think, we're going down the Sean Dyche route.
Yeah.
Or will they look at Watford and say, you know what? That kind of streak of madness sort of works too.
I don't know. I mean, they have, there's a quaintness to the Bournemouth story, because just they're, you know, they're not exactly playing in a 40,000 seat stadium, but they did have Russian ownership that played a big part in them actually, it strengthened their position once they got to the Premier League. So I don't know. I don't think the relegation picture is that clear cut. Like, it's actually pretty congested down there, and all it really takes for even Freddie Howe. Now, they did play with 10 men for a portion of the game at the weekend too, but there's no doubt their form has been, they've been tanking for a while. But all it does take is two or three wins, and suddenly, you know, you're in a good position. So they're not being cut adrift. I mean, Norwich needed that to avoid being cut adrift almost. Mm. But
that said, Norwich would have been, you know, kind of a game they would hope to win.
So. Yeah, so I think they're, you know, like, it's worrying, but I can't imagine, you'd be disappointed if they behaved too rashly. There's no suggestion. I don't know. We're not the Bournemouth sort of Daily Echo here. Maybe there's rumblings on the ground that things aren't right, but certainly externally, there's no sense that there's anything like that going on there. So it might just be they've lost form a bit, and yeah, maybe one or two bodies.
Chelsea didn't take their chances against Newcastle. They really should have. They lost 1-0. And Leicester, coinciding to some extent with Ndidi's injury, I've gone off a bit of a cliff now. Burnley beat them 2-1 yesterday, came back from 1-0 down to win that game. And then at Anfield, Dan, the key jewel of the weekend at Anfield.
You say Pep's the best, one of the best coaches in the world. What did he do in his first year at Manchester City? One of the greatest coaches around, a messiah. What did he do with Man City in his first year?
Finishing the Champions League.
Finishing the Champions League, and that's good enough for the best coach in the world, you're thinking. Finishing the Champions League.
His first year in the league, and then he brought the full
And then
back.
He brought some players in.
Yeah.
Exactly. Even he had to sit back and go, he had to go to Man City and say, I need some players. Mm. I need to get four fullbacks into the football club.
Who was the biggest spenders in the summer?
I'm going to have a guess. Man United?
Yeah.
But I make the point. The recruitment has been up to it. That can't be just down to Ollie. Who's deciding who's bringing... I don't know. Your guess is as good as mine. Who was bringing the players in when David Moyes was there? Who was bringing the players in when Van Gaal was there? What about the previous managers over the last few years? Are you saying they're all bad managers?
Manchester United?
Yeah,
Mourinho. Do you think they've done good jobs?
Mourinho?
You slaughtered Mourinho when he was in the job.
But he needed more time.
He needed more time?
Yeah.
You'd give Mourinho more time
absolutely.
On the back of the performance
his CV,
last year.
Absolutely. That's the name of the game.
CV.
We question all, he's not up to it. Look at his CV. But yet for some reason, other managers go to clubs and they're given the benefit of the doubt.
Probably the CV gives them the benefit of the doubt.
Frank Lampard's at Chelsea. I saw Chelsea last night.
He's been in the job 6 months.
And I'd say the same. Give him time. Give Ollie a bit of time. How long's Ollie been in the job?
What is it, 18 months? Just over 12
Isn't that long? I don't think it's 18 months.
Last defeat here was, well, that's
can we find out? Find out how long's Ollie been in the job.
It was the defeat here at Old Trafford, wasn't it? For Jose Mourinho that did
it in
December 18th.
16 months. Give the man a chance. I watched Chelsea last night. Chelsea, decent team. They couldn't get the job done. Frank Lampard's lost 8 games. But for some reason, Frank's doing all right. Frank, maybe because he's English. I don't know.
Well, he's ahead of Frank's, right.
Frank's track record, CV, went to Derby, didn't get promoted. But Frank's got all the answers for Chelsea. He hasn't.
But you will.
Give him time.
Yeah,
I'd say give the man time.
I completely agree.
It's nothing to do with Ollie and all this carry on. Give him a time. And the three previous managers before Ollie, are you telling me they don't know what the game is about, Jamie? They know what the game is about. David Moyes has given a six-year contract. Alex Ferguson on the pitch going,
so you'd have kept
get behind the manager, back him.
Would you have
I would have given
David
him a bit
Moyes?
More time. Not
would
8
you have
months.
Given 6 years?
Not
then?
8 months, and I wouldn't have sacked him on Twitter. I wouldn't have given him 8 months. Are you telling me David Moyes doesn't deserve more than 8 months?
I think he did, yeah.
Yeah, he deserves.
Absolutely.
So you still have him there in the job? Okay, well, how long would you give Ollie to
give Ollie certainly not a year. 100%. Not a year.
So... there we are. I don't think Dave Jones's nerves can take it anymore. I think he needs a break. Civil. They know the game. There are so many magical moments in this. Matt Letizia replied that his favourite aspect, like a lot of people's, was that when they realised December 2018 was when Mourinho had packed up, that this was 16 months ago.
Yeah.
16. Right, 16.
But like Keane was like, come on, Jones, give us, you're a
can we find out?
Dude.
Can we find
give
out?
Us the months. You know, get your phone out there. Like, have a look, you know.
Like they were buzzing in Jones's ear again. January, or December.
Months. 13 months, Dave. 13 months.
And even at the finish, how long would you give him then? Like, how can you answer that? Does he lose 10 games in a row, or is he on fire? And so Keane just randomly goes, a year.
Another year.
What are you going to do about it? A year.
Yeah. I mean, it's strong stuff. I mean, I don't know. Like, obviously, Keane, you know, has Ollie invited Keane in at one point, didn't he, to speak to the players?
Keane's been in to speak to the players, and Solskjaer was at Keane's house. I wouldn't think Roy invites you over to his house and let you, unless you're in the good books,
so,
to chat with him about his impressions of the United team and where they need to go.
I would suggest that might make him slightly more disposed towards Ollie and not sort of wanting to lead the mob. I do think, I mean, Roy Keane and and Martin O'Neill always get on quite well. I mean, we know that, like, you know, they're a part of a team. And I think that they probably, one of the things they had in common, and you would hear this, you know, is that they probably shared, you know, a view of, they were sort of sceptical of a certain brand of manager who they felt might get an easy time along the way. And actually, it used to always go back to whatever tensions I think they had, like Roberto Martinez and people, guys that they felt would speak a good game afterwards and could actually, because of how they could present themselves in the media, they maybe didn't necessarily get the scrutiny that others might.
Frank Lampard.
And then, like, it comes to with Lampard, like, is it because he's English, you know? Now, Carragher makes a reasonable point. Lampard hasn't had a transfer window at all, whereas, you know, Manchester United have spent a lot of money, including under Solskjaer in the summer. Admittedly, you know, with some younger players, you know, Daniel James, etc., who over time may turn out to be good boys. So, I mean, I get that. But it's not the most consistent point in the world. Like, I mean, how long would he have given how long would he have given Moyes, say?
Not 8 months, and he wouldn't have sacked him on Twitter.
Not on Twitter, which is a great line.
He actually even managed to squeeze in an Alex Ferguson mention there as well. Somehow Ferguson got roped into it.
Ferguson had to get involved. Like, it was all coming back to Ferguson to some degree. But
this is what Sky wanted.
This is
what Keane brings.
But Keane, you've been on a stage with an angry Roy Keane. You know, it's like when he takes off, he takes off. And it really doesn't matter if he's 100% correct or not. If he has the conviction to back himself on his point, then it can be hard for anyone to totally back up. And we've already had, like, some of the Keane Carragher back and forths are brilliant. Yeah. Because Keane still ultimately is sitting there with perspective of, you sense that he's like, he sort of respects Carragher to a degree, but didn't really win. Didn't, you know, well, Champions League, but didn't really win.
Yeah,
he wasn't a consistent winner.
But Carragher has understood you can't back down here.
Oh no!
If you pick this fight, you have to raise your voice back. You can't be shouted down. You can't look weak. And so he went back at him, and it was actually a good discussion.
But that's what people say, though. Again, in real life, yeah, as opposed to away from studio life, is that with Keane, that ultimately he would actually respect you more if you took him on.
Yes.
But also, if you take him on, it can get interesting as well. You know, it can. Some people don't believe that the, you know, the angry man conviction is as, like, for example, like John Walters' defence of, you know, John Walters hitting back at Roy Keane. I know we're taking it to a slightly different area here. Yeah. But John Walters would always say that actually, if you confronted Keane and took him on, that he wasn't as intimidating as you might think. Mm-hmm. You know, and that would be his view. And clearly, see, there was always this thing when Roy Keane was a manager. Was a manager, and hopefully hopes to be a manager again. And even you experience it to a degree that when Roy Keane gets angry, there's always an assumption that whoever's on the other side of the camera or on the back or on the receiving end of it is beaten, has lost. Because there's always that famous one about Roy Keane giving at Ipswich about the phone ringing. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
And the whole line was, not going to turn it off. And this almost got sent around, like, the internet world as, oh, look at Roy Keane tearing this reporter to shreds. When actually, the reporter in question was an old guy who was a mate of Fergie's going back to Aberdeen, and was almost, no, I'm not answering the phone. And was indignant.
Yeah.
And was almost like, I'm not going to answer. Yeah. The phone, and was taking him on, and that's actually what made Keane more annoyed. Whereas the assumption is, oh, Roy's getting angry, he must be beating, he's winning this argument well, look at them, they're bowing to him, he's done. And Carragher's just sort of thinking, yeah, I'll take him on a bit, I'll hit back a bit. And actually, I don't know, how would you score it as a joust? Like, who got the better of that?
That's
of
an
that
interesting
exchange
question. I mean, when
you still end up thinking it's Keane, because he just gets so, yeah, he has this way about him that you feel like he's dominating the room and other people are afraid to get almost involved, so you feel like he probably still has edges. But I wonder, is it exaggerated sometimes because his anger can be so ferocious?
I thought Carragher held his own. Like, certainly when Keane's on stage with me and Nathan, there's such a power imbalance. It's very hard to win any argument with.
Oh, yeah.
Quite clear. It's actually pretty much impossible, whereas Carragher can. The interesting thing about Roy is the angrier he gets, he becomes more composed and his brain quickens up.
Yeah.
That's why I think he can launch these verbal paragraphs of anger. He can spit out stuff, because I think, as opposed to losing his composure and just being overcome by anger, he really sharpens up the verbal skills. He can come. And so he hits Carragher with all that. But I thought Carragher was good, and he called out, rightfully, you slaughtered Mourinho.
Yeah.
And that landed. Television is about one-liners. That's what I've learned increasingly about it. Like, even half time, Patrice Mann, wake up. That's all I remember from their discussion of the Van Dijk foul.
Yeah.
Patrice Mann, wake up. And Keane, either consciously or unconsciously, has realised this about television. And maybe Carragher, to a point, has as well. So, you slaughtered Mourinho. That landed really well.
Who spent the most last summer as well.
Yeah.
You know, and that was see, like, he held his own. He got a couple of, he might lose it on points, but he definitely has come away with a bit of respect, you know.
This is a Sky Sports loving here, because they certainly were the centre of the action yesterday. So
this is what they want.
Gary Neville, on his podcast after the game, has made headlines by being pretty clear on what he thinks should happen with Ed Woodward and the general hierarchy at the club.
I can't believe the investment that's been put into the squad over the last 5 or 6 years, 7 years, and you end up with that out on the pitch.
Yeah.
I cannot believe it. I saw a statistic 2 weeks ago, I think it was a week ago, on social media, that Manchester United have the second highest wage bill in the world. And that's the team that they've got. That's the squad. It's unforgivable. It really is. And look, I can't change the ownership of Manchester United. No one can. I'm struggling to understand for the life of me why the ownership have persisted in trusting that management team to oversee the building of a Premier League title-winning team since Sir Alex Ferguson's left. Because if you don't lose your job for essentially overseeing that investment, that wage bill, and putting that team out onto the pitch, then I have to say something's really wrong. And there's real talent within that executive team. They can create revenue, they can do things within the football club that, to be fair, would help the football club. But in terms of what the club needed to do for a number of years now, for the last 2 or 3 years, is put the best in class football operators into that club, and they're not doing it. They're not doing it, and it's a mess, and they need to sort it out quickly. And the thing that should shock the owners more than anything is seeing that last minute goal, and they should have that playing on record every single day in their office over in America, Liverpool Football Club's fans singing "We Shall Not Be Moved." And that's how I feel tonight. I feel slightly emotional. I was proud to be part of a great Manchester United team. I lived through a difficult childhood as a United fan, witnessing Liverpool win every single year, it felt like. And then Manchester United started to win and maintain it over a long period of time. And things do go in cycles, and there is an element of, well, it was always going to come back. Liverpool, you have to accept, are a huge football club. But there is some really difficult decisions need to be made in that boardroom at Manchester United in terms of, I can't believe the squad they've ended up with after the investment that they've made.
That's a regular theme, but that was Neville's reaction at full time on the podcast. I wanted to get your thoughts on one other thing. Now, I'll be accused of reading too much into this, so let me just say
read too much into it. Go, read away, John.
Okay, I'll read away. So this kind of caught me by surprise a little bit. And David Myler is on the way, by the way. He was on COCOM for the game with us alongside Nathan yesterday. We chatted at full time. He does a brilliant analysis of Bissaka and Williams and how it put Luke Shaw in a difficult position with Salah, and gets into the intricacies of the game. And that's on the way in a couple of minutes' time. On Sky Sports, after the Keane Carragher discussion, and, you know, Gary Neville is somewhere else in the gantry recording his podcast, Solskjaer is interviewed, obviously, by Jeff Shreves. There's a moment where the Marcus Rashford situation comes up. So just have a listen. This is Jeff Shreves with Solskjaer.
When we spoke to you before the game and asked you about Marcus Rashford, you said, don't expect to see him before the international break. That's 9 weeks away. Is it a stress fracture?
I didn't say international break, did I? He's suffered a bad injury, yeah.
I need to be clear. Is it a stress fracture, a double stress fracture, his back?
Yeah. It's a stress fracture that it happened against Wolverhampton, and it's not something that has happened before. Is that the one there and then? So unlucky for Marcus, he'll be out for a while for us. Yeah.
Is it more likely to be months than weeks?
Yeah, he won't be back until after the mid-season break. I don't know how long it is. I'm not the doctor, but normally stress fracture is 6 weeks to heal. And then he needs some recovery after that, or rehab after that, probably.
When you watched it, what was very obvious was that Solskjaer did not want to divulge much about Rashford. He gave his initial answer, and then he gave another answer, and then we picked it up there where Shreves said, hang on, Ollie, what's the story here? And there's this pause, and you see Solskjaer kind of looking almost sheepishly at the floor for a second, as if he has no option but to answer, and he says, yeah. And we were watching it in the office here because we were in doing the show yesterday. And the childhood Manchester United fan in me was reared on Alex Ferguson saying, "Well done, Jeff."
Yeah.
Bullying Jeff Shreves, assuming the role of, "I am the Manchester United manager. I am running this interview. Jeff, it's not you." If you're talking about one of the potential failings of Solskjaer is his personality and a failure to sort of imbue the role, I'm not parking in Alex Ferguson's spot.
Mm.
Solskjaer, in that instance, needs to tell Jeff Shreves, "Jeff, I've answered the question. We'll release a statement. Now move on."
Yeah.
He needs to Martin O'Neill that man.
Yeah.
And instead... But
then, hang on, you see, Martin O'Neill, I mean, never played well for Martin O'Neill when the results weren't going well, did it?
I understand.
Which is the whole point. Steve Staunton tried to do a bit of... Steve Staunton would answer nothing, but like the results were bad, so as a result, it didn't come across as genius. It was more, what's going on here?
Ole Solskjaer will never come across like Martin O'Neill.
No.
Martin O'Neill picked on Tony when there was no need to pick a thing. Mm. Like, he picked on him when there were like at draws, you know, and it's just like, we're looking forward to the campaign. Nice to see you. Done.
Yeah.
He did it at every instance. That will never be in Solskjaer's character to do no. that. He will always come across in the main very well. But he has to start drawing lines. He has to start bullying Jeff a little bit back. And I'm sitting there with the lads. I just went, "Oh, no. Ole, come on."
So do you think if he'd said it in a, like, Jeff, pretty much as he said it there, that people would be like, great to see it. Or they'd be like, "Geez, nice guy is turning tough. Geez, it must be getting to him."
They might have done the latter, but I think it's no harm showing a bit of steel.
But I think the problem with that one was the Rashford stuff had broken during the game.
Sure.
The Kenny Winter had some information. So, like, he was fighting a losing battle on that one.
Well,
so
if that's the case, then just come out and say, "Well, I'm just going to tell the media."
Yeah.
But it was very obvious he did not want to share the information. He was holding it back.
But it was almost like I wonder, had the strategy of the club to be, "We're not going to release this, not today."
Yeah.
Then it comes out, and then in fairness to him, he's been engaged in the match for the last couple of hours.
Then as a strategy, it's weak.
I sort of feel like someone should have gone to him before, and maybe they did, and the press said, "Listen, this has come out during the game." You know,
maybe.
Someone should have maybe, so he could have managed that situation.
Or whatever.
I take your point, but I do think, isn't that just one of the things that the interviewer will react to? Like, you talk about, say, you were on stage with Roy Keane, right? Mm-hmm. You would speak in a certain way to Roy Keane, again, because
yes.
of how you felt. If you were on stage with Kenny or Kev Coban or someone,
yeah.
you would, asking on the similar subject matter, you would just behave in a completely different way.
Of course,
because
yeah.
you know the boundaries are different,
yes.
because you know... You know them better,
yeah.
I guess,
yeah.
or you're not, and you don't know what the relationship. I mean, Jeff and Solskjaer have dealt with each other loads, so it's just that type of relationship where you can sort of get away with it more. But there is, I know what you're saying. There is something about the, like, there's a, you know yourself when you're interviewing someone, and I know that, like, sometimes if you're dealing with someone that you know can be tough, you will probably moderate the way you ask questions
yeah.
accordingly, almost subconsciously.
Yeah.
And if it's someone that you're too familiar with, it's almost can be borderline disrespectful to sort of cut them and say, "Listen, come on." And I do take your point, but I think if you'd gone the other way, people would have also mightn't have gone fair play to him. They might have been like, "Oh, he's rattled, they've lost, he's kicking off here."
Well, then maybe as a compromise, he could have just said, "Look, Jeff, very politely, look, that's all I have to say about it now. We'll release a statement in due course. But don't set out your stall, I'm not releasing the information," and then get into a mini arm wrestle with Jeff Shreves, which lasts about half of a second before you wilt.
Yeah, it's true. And I see your point.
I just want him to start parking in Ferguson's car space. Maybe he has. I mean, take that as, like, the, you know, the
Ferguson's just trying to reverse
symbolism.
Now. Trying to reverse out, and there's a car just driven in behind them.
Yeah. Look, ultimately, I thought he set the team up well yesterday, and it was a decent performance. And I did say you can be accused of reading too much into that, but I just wanted to play it to you anyway. I acknowledge it's
okay.
not the be all and end all. John Delaney has resigned from UEFA. I have to be honest, I thought this may have had happened already.
I think a lot of people feel that way, yeah.
So, statement from UEFA. UEFA takes note of John Delaney's resignation with immediate effect from his position as UEFA Executive Committee member, which was due to end in 2021. During his time on the Executive Committee, John played a leading role in helping UEFA to achieve many things. He was instrumental in the expansion of the Euros to 24 teams, which proved such a success in 2016. Several teams may not otherwise have qualified. He goes on to say, or they go on to say, UEFA. that was
well,
genuine.
That's interesting.
That was Freudian.
I think you actually couldn't say any more in this slot than that, to be honest. You couldn't say any more about the statement than that, because there was a...
I'll finish
what UEFA said.
I'm just conscious people are busy all day and may not have heard. He was an important figure in the move to centralise the TV rights across national team competition, something which has benefited all UEFA member associations and which was rolled out into the new UEFA Nations League tournament. UEFA wishes him well in the future. Yeah. So very much at odds with the send-off he got in the FAI statement.
Yeah, well, I think it was known, or certainly, you know, I would be aware that when John Delaney left the FAI, he would have liked more achievements in his departure press release and did not receive that. But as we do know, he did receive money as part of a severance package, as you do. I'm not sure if he's received anything from UEFA in terms of a severance package, but maybe they proposed this for all we know, but he did get the statement that he might have wanted leaving the FAI to hail his tributes. Bit of a surprise to the people, of course, from Iceland and Wales, who didn't realise that actually, when they enjoyed the glorious summer of 2016, the hero who made it happen was skulking away in the background, unbeknownst to them.
It's a nice sheen on the new LinkedIn profile, though. It allows him to exit in a certain way.
Of course, but also he's resigned 2 years out from the end of his term.
Yeah.
It
doesn't matter ultimately.
I don't think, maybe, you know, people who read this news in Turkey or Latvia or whatever might just assume, you know, because they obviously don't care about domestic affairs here. They might just think that successful administrator just decided to wake up today and retire or resign.
Must have a new gig lined up.
Coming. He's obviously resigned because he's going to be announced as the new manager of FIFA tomorrow. but obviously that's not the case. So, yeah. 2020 in UEFA could have been a glorious year for John Delaney. It will not be that.
Before we go, and the clock is now very much against us, you just wanted to highlight for people Connor Masterson.
Yeah, well, we were talking about off air, but Erling Haaland scoring a hat trick for Dortmund at the weekend, an 18-year-old kid. But like,
a hat trick after coming off the bench in 56 minutes.
Yeah,
we watched it. A very nice hat trick.
But it's good that we have our own generation of like good young players that we can be interested in. Masterson's a bit different one. Went to Liverpool very young, moved for like £1 million, a deal worth £1 million when he was 13. So he's been on the radar for a long time. At 21 at the weekend, he made his first league start in English football, which goes to show the difference of going to a big club and then waiting your turn. Played for QPR against Leeds, televised game, did well. One or two moments that reminds you this is his first league game. Patrick Bamford spun him once, and small bit of an experience, but still another one to add, that did very well. They won the game, clean sheet. Yeah. Another one to add to the list of players making their way. So hopefully long may it continue. We're not just looking at exciting players in other countries.
Very good. Dan McDonald of the Irish Independent, thank you. Next up, David Myler spoke to us at full time at Anfield yesterday. His analysis of the game next.
Paddy Power, as much a part of Irish football as celebrating a home draw.
Okay, you're welcome back. So Joe Malloy with you here in studio. Enough from me and Dan McDonald for the time being. Yesterday we had live commentary of the game from Anfield. David Myler was alongside Nathan Murphy at full time. I got chatting to David Myler.
As defeats go, this isn't all that mood damaging for Manchester United.
No, I think Manchester United could take a lot of positives. The first thing, the goal they conceded with Virgil van Dijk. If you're fortunate enough to watch it back on telly, you'll notice that they do zonal marking. So it's obviously something Liverpool have worked on. Jurgen Klopp has always been a big fan of outswinging corners. But they set up a one in the front space and five across the six-yard line. And then they have blockers. Now, it ended up being Brandon Williams who's on Virgil van Dijk. Now, the role of a blocker is just to stop him getting a clear run. But when you have someone who's 6'5", who's probably 14 stone of pure muscle, he gets a run on Brandon Williams, and then it's on, like Harry Maguire is trying to get across and he's scrambling, but Van Dijk has the run and the delivery is exceptional and it's a great header. But besides that, and then you could talk about the opening 5 minutes of the second half where Man United were all over the place. They were just constantly trying to play out from the back and they were getting everything wrong. They were just inviting Liverpool onto them. They were turning over possession in bad areas. They were just giving chance after chance. You would have expected Liverpool to score, but like they just suddenly grew into the game. And Martial had a fantastic chance that you'd expect him to score. It was a lovely little 1-2. He's about 7 yards out and
he's usually so calm in those moments, he's cold, he's clinical, and he went for the laces instead of trying to place it.
Yeah, I know. And, you know, he ballooned it over the bar. And at that moment, the game was probably on a coin. It was, you know, if United had scored there, like, Liverpool would have been frustrated. You'd probably still expect them to come back and, you know, go through the motions and get back into it. And but United were on top at that time, and, you know, they were playing some good stuff. It's what's so special about games like this is when it's Manchester United v Liverpool, like, form kind of goes out the window. It's a big rivalry. You could tell even, you know, the last 10 minutes when United were throwing everything at it, the Liverpool fans were on the edge of their seats. They were moaning and groaning at every clearance, everything, and they just all, it almost felt as if they expected Manchester United to score.
Yeah, Liverpool only really, by their standards, played in two bursts. After the first goal, which was, you know, such a momentum changer because United had started quite well. And then you even said on commentary, this has settled Liverpool right down. They're suddenly fluid, they're moving, they're comfortable. You know, everything's in front of them, it's lovely. And then after the second half, they were electric in those few minutes after the second half. Besides those two 10, 15 minute spells, by their standards, they weren't electric today.
No, they weren't. But the point is, this team is just finding ways all the time to win games. Mm. That is the beauty of it. They weren't fantastic today. You'd probably rate them like a solid 6 out of 10. Do you know, I said to Nathan a while ago, like, they brought on Adam Lallana at 65 minutes. It probably was the wrong substitution at the time. It kind of killed the momentum. I said in commentary that I felt he would come on and add control. The game had become so open. Oxlade Chamberlain was bursting forward, so there was, you know, spaces being created in midfield. Mm. But Adam Lallana couldn't get to, you know,
the pitch of it.
Couldn't get to grips with the intensity of it straight away, which is, you know, the hard thing when you are a substitute and you do come on. You have to get into the game as quickly as possible, and it took him probably 10 or 15 minutes to get into it, which was Man United's main time of, you know, threatening Liverpool for an equaliser.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny, you made the point that they're just finding ways to win, and when you watch them, you have that sense. Even when United are on top, you just have some kind of sense that Liverpool will find a way. It's a funny thing that if this run was only starting now, and say we had the Spurs game and the United game today, you would almost say to yourself, geez, well, they won't keep getting away with it. But the fact is, they've been getting away with it for such a long time now that for whatever reason, they are getting away with it.
Yeah, no, it's like everybody will just say Liverpool have won the league title. You know, Nathan said to me, surely they've won the league title. I'm kind of going, in the back of my mind, you're still thinking they can't continue to go on like this. I said ages ago when they were in such a successful run, I felt February would be the time they would, you know, drop points. I don't know why I have that in my head. Everyone was talking about the Christmas fixture list. I just felt that February would be the time where they'll draw games. But look,
do you still think
their
that?
Lead, I still do for some reason. I don't think they'll go unbeaten. I don't know why. I think they'll just have a game where there'll be a couple of mistakes or something that will just be just the way it will go, yeah. And I think they'll end up losing again, but that then will refocus the team again. But I don't think they're looking at the invincible record. I think they're just so solely focused on winning that first Premier League title.
If you were in that dressing room, would you be mentioning the invincible thing? We've got to keep, like, in a sense, everybody knows the league is probably done. They probably know it deep down and they're enjoying that. Would you be in that dressing room thinking, it's worth, even as motivation, even as a keep everybody on their toes and focused, we should be going for 49. We should be going for 49. Getting that into everyone's head. Would you use that?
No, I wouldn't. You're going to see a whole host of social media interviews, interviews with Sky, what have you, match of the day. And I guarantee you, every player will say, we're just focused on the next game. I think that really is their mentality. That's what Jurgen Klopp has instilled in them. They're just looking at their next fixture next week, and then they will just say, we're going to win this game. We're going to win this game. They don't think of the invincible record. I think it will only become something once the league title is actually mathematically won. I don't think they'll actually focus on it. And of course, they also need to win it, but also be unbeaten at that time once they've won it.
I thought Fred and Matic had very good games for United.
Yeah, no, I thought... I would say Fred had a very good game. I was impressed with him. Matic at times was sloppy. I would love to sit down with him and see what's kind of going on with him.
Yeah.
Because the Matic that was at Chelsea when he signed, I remember telling my friends who are Manchester United fans, I said, that's an incredible signing. I'm a big fan of Nemanja Matic. I think he's a superb holding midfielder. At times today he was a bit loose, but like, he hasn't played a lot under Solskjaer. He seems to be coming back in and around the team. But you know, maybe if they could get him firing again alongside Fred, and maybe they could play Pogba, you know, Pogba could play just in front of them, where then Paul Pogba has the license to kind of go forward and do everything, because look, Pogba has every attribute you'd want in a footballer. You know, if they can get him firing, and then obviously he has the cover, knowing that Matic is behind him and won't move and will look after that defensive, you know, responsibility that Paul Pogba won't have to do, I think you could probably get the best out of Paul Pogba. That's the Paul Pogba that was at Juventus. You know, he was always fortunate that he had Vidal and Pirlo, Marchisio and Matuidi, who did the defensive work for him, and he was just left to go forward and left to go create.
Maybe Matic caught the eye more because we haven't seen him in so long. I just assumed he must have gone off a cliff completely. I just assumed his leg must have gone. And so the fact that he looked vaguely quite like Matic and kind of okay maybe added to the sense of, oh, geez, he's not finished yet completely, because he's just disappeared.
I agree with you. Like, from the Matic I'm thinking of, the one I played against, that wasn't one of those performances.
Sure.
I think, yes, he was good. But like if you really think about it, he's been in and out. Obviously he's come into the team recently. He's not been playing regularly, like say an entire season. But I think if that Matic continues to play week in, week out, like he did today, he'll only get better and better, and that will be huge for Manchester United.
Just a final few thoughts from you. You spelled it out very clearly at one stage in the first half about the pros and cons of what Solskjaer tried to do today. And it's interesting as we try and judge what kind of manager Solskjaer is. So you picked out Williams and Bissaka. And so they're part of a back five, essentially. But really, they were really pushing up on Robertson and Trent Alexander-Arnold. And you were making the point that there's a real pro to that for sure. The downside is if, for instance, Salah comes short, then Shaw sort of has to go with them. And suddenly there's a lot of space for midfielders to run into in that left-hand channel, United's left-hand channel, Liverpool's right side. And that was the really interesting game of chess that Solskjaer and Klopp were playing today. Do you think that was an impressive thing of Solskjaer to try? Did you think it worked? Does it show a certain kind of sophistication? You mentioned you like Mike Phelan. How did you think all that worked?
Well, you would have to say it did work. The goals I conceded were a set piece and obviously like a counter-attack when they're throwing the kitchen at it, that like Alisson grabs the ball and kicks on the pitch. They limited Trent Alexander-Arnold Robertson. Do you know, the lads had good, you know, had good afternoons, Wan-Bissaka and Luke Shaw and Brandon Williams. You know, the interesting thing is, like, it took Liverpool too long to realise that it is very difficult when you're in, you know, when you're playing and you're on the pitch. It's only the special players can identify something so soon. But that was the one, was Shaw was better at going with Salah than, like, Lindelof didn't want to step out of that area because he's obviously comfortable and he's used to playing as a two sitting like that. Like, he didn't want to step out into no man's land. So then it left, you know, Mane and Firmino took turns going over there to try and get on the ball and get half turned. That's why Wan-Bissaka was a bit caught at times. He was up against Robertson, but then the problem was the gap between him and Lindelof was too big that your Mane or your Firmino could get turned and, you know, try and create something. But
so in your world, Lindelof should have done what Shaw was doing. If, you know, you can push him to go out a little bit, try.
Yeah, but then when Shaw did that, there was times when he went up against him, there was times then Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain ran in behind because he's leaving acres of space. So it is, looks like Russian roulette at times. You know, if you, like Lindelof would say, well, his argument would be, well, the player's in front of me, I can see the ball, I'm not running back towards my own goal, I'm defending it properly. So, you know, there is a catch for both of them. But I felt, you know, they did well. You can't say, like, of course it was one slip and Salah should score. He's 6 yards out and he kicks the ball from his left foot onto his right foot and it dribbles past the post. But, you know, inevitably United did well. You know, they were solid. Obviously there was that 5 minutes after halftime we spoke about, which was all over the place. They couldn't string 3-4 passes together. And
was that just more about Liverpool being on fire? You know, sometimes they can just get in a flow and it's very difficult to interrupt it.
Yeah, they suffocated them. They just set little traps. It was like, you'd arc your players so Mane would start higher on top of the right back or the right side of centre half, and you'd have Firmino over a little bit, so they'd encourage them to play the ball left. But it's just the way they press together in numbers. But they were just, Manchester United didn't realise. Liverpool tried to play out at one stage and Alisson kicked the ball out for a throw-in and there was big moans and groans, but the next time it came to him, he put the ball down and he waved everyone away. He said, get up the pitch.
Yeah.
It took Manchester United 7-8 goal kicks to do that, whereas you have to identify that. That was just after, you know, the start of half time. Like, Henderson had made De Gea pull off a wonderful save. Like I said, Salah had a great chance. That's where you just need to put the ball down and say, get off the pitch, get away from here.
Yeah,
no, we need to settle into it and get on the ball.
Yeah, you said that as well. Just get up the pitch, win it free. I totally agree with that. Like, too often we are seeing teams... If Liverpool set a trap for you, I mean, don't be silly. I mean, if they line up in that arc that you kind of painted there and say Luke Shaw or Williams is your obvious outball as a goalkeeper and it looks a little bit too obvious and a little bit too easy, there's probably a good reason it does.
Yeah, but there was another prime example. A cross came in, De Gea came and caught it. And Fred was probably 10 yards outside the box. And he had his back to play. He took it on the back foot, but there was four Liverpool players swarmed him. It was almost like we're encouraged all the time to get on the ball, receive it and play forward. But at times, you've got to sense the game. This was a proper derby today. There was tackles. It was intense. Like, both teams fighting for their clubs to try and win the game. And it was just that period. Manchester United were just making poor decisions. And Liverpool will be kicking themselves. I imagine they'll probably watch it back tomorrow after training. And, you know, Jurgen Klopp will identify things. But you can't invite a team like Liverpool onto you. That the way they press and they go after teams, they just suffocated them.
Yeah, teams will have to get sharper and read these kind of things themselves increasingly, and that's the sophistication and brilliance of Liverpool. So final thoughts. It's not a humiliation for United by any means. There's lots they can take from the game. I mean, in the wider sense, they're still in this inconsistent run of two steps forward and three steps back and then four steps forward, and it's hard to know quite where they are. But today, not one of the really bad days. For Liverpool, they get it done again. They find a way again. They should win the Champions League as well, shouldn't they?
Oh. Look, I don't know, but they should win the Champions League. But it's crazy to think that they're not even, you know, they're not regarded as favourites to win the Champions League.
Who are favourites?
I believe Real Madrid are. You might want to check that.
I'll check. You talk, I'll check.
Yeah, but the thing, it's just interesting that, you know, they're so far ahead in the Premier League. They're playing exceptional football. They are the Champions League holders that, you know, you think... But if they were to pick up two or three injuries, and I don't even want to think about it. They just need to focus. Like, I'm going to give you the answer that they're all going to give us.
We've been saying all year about injuries. I've got the odds here.
Go on.
Favourites are Manchester City.
Okay.
Followed by Liverpool. Followed by Barcelona. Followed by Munich. I don't see Madrid here at all, actually. Madrid are 16-1. They're well down. So it's City or Liverpool is City or Liverpool's how the bookies see it. Which is kind of how I'd see it too. Is English football not ahead of Barca and Bayern and PSG?
No, I agree. Yeah, well, if you look at it, like Man City last year, obviously coming so close. Tottenham, obviously playing in the final against Liverpool. So you have three of the four, you know.
Mm.
So that just shows. I don't know where I heard Real Madrid. I apologise for that stat.
No, that's fine.
But
it just shows. Yeah, go on.
It shows that, like, Liverpool and Man City are dominating, but I just want Liverpool to focus on the Premier League. Just get that first Premier League title out of the way. Like, they have 18 championships, or they've won, but they've no Premier League. That's the hard thing. And if they get that one, you know, it could be one of those where he just, like, slightly rotates the team and look, the momentum of their winning streak and how they're playing and the way things are going, they could just end up rolling on, and next minute you know you're in a semi-final. They've probably, you know, they might have won the league at the end of March, and then all of a sudden you can kind of concentrate on the Champions League.
And maybe that's the tricky thing, actually, because when teams win the league, little wobbles come in and maybe you lose a bit of momentum. I suppose the real benefit is he can still, in the vast majority of matches, play his best team and next game and next game, but maybe if needs be on the Saturday before a big Champions League knockout game, then he can rest certain players. That's the real luxury they have now.
Yeah, but even when he rests players, the players that come in end up performing and producing the goods, and it's amazing.
And the Van Dijks don't, like, Van Dijk doesn't seem to be a fellow who needs a rest. You don't look at him and say he's crying out for it.
No, but the problem Virgil van Dijk has, he plays in second gear. Like, we've have we really seen him, like, have to go to the heights, like, in performances, in games? He doesn't have to hit that. He just reads the game so well. He's so strong, he's so quick. Even today, when Man United were peppering the box, every ball, like Nathan said in commentary, he's like a magnet to his head. The ball just kept falling to him. It's just, that's not luck, you know? He's in the right position because he's such a good defender, and he just clears everything.
David Myler talking to us there at full time at Anfield yesterday.
Paddy Power and the Football Show, the greatest football partnership since Geoffin Heskey.
Alrighty, so we're pretty much done for the evening. As usual, I should remind you, OTBAM is back tomorrow. It is our daily sports breakfast show, 7:30. You can get it on all social channels and listen as well on OTB Sports Radio via the Go Loud app, which you should download if you haven't already. Ger and Owen are going to have the Wexford hurler Conor McDonald in studio. They'll also be chatting rugby with Tommy Bowe, so that's on the way tomorrow from 7:30. Then tomorrow night, we're back at 7 o'clock as usual. We will have, well, the main man, hurler of the year, All-Ireland winner, scored a goal in every championship game last summer, Seamus Callanan, fresh off one of the greatest championship seasons any of us will ever see, is in studio to reflect on it all, and hey, no pressure for 2020. We will also have the Irish cricket captain, Andrew Balburnie, in studio as well. That is on the back of Ireland's historic drawn T20 series against the West Indies, which I'm sure you saw last week. So be good to catch up with him and chat about all that. In the meantime, Tom Dunn is up next. Good luck.
With guilt like your eyes.